Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to The Critic Books podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, and this week I'm speaking to Jennifer Saint about her new book, Ariadne. Subscribe to The Critic Books podcast on Spotify or Apple Podcasts so you never miss an episode. Jennifer read classical studies at King's College London before becoming an English teacher. Ariadne is her first novel. Jennifer, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's so brilliant to talk to you. So your first novel, Ariadne, tells the story of the Greek myth of Ariadne, the Cretan princess and daughter of Minos, who helps Theseus overcome the Minotaur before being deserted by him on the island of Naxos. So your novel starts as an extract from Ovid's Herodes, letters from women in Greek mythology, and not just Greek mythology, actually, but to the men who wronged them. In this extract, Ariadne describes how Theseus will be praised in Athens, despite the fact that he's left her on the island by herself. So evidently, Ovid's poems are one of the many possible sources of the myth, but what other sources did you use?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on the podcast. I'm so glad to be invited. So other sources, I mean, Ovid was where I started, definitely, because it's not just Ariadne's letter. As you said, that's what I opened the novel with. But there is also Phaedra's letter in the Herodes as well. So that really gave me a jumping off point for the characters of these two women, because in these letters, as Ovid wrote them, they are both, I think what really comes across about both of them is their anger and their passion and their furious desire to be heard and to have the chance to put things in their own words and tell their side of the story. So that was a really great place to begin with who I wanted these two women to be, but also how I wanted them to be different and have their own distinct voices as they do in the Herodes. Aside from that, certainly for the character of Phaedra, I used the Euripides play Hippolytus, and in that play you get quite a different view of Phaedra's situation. She was a character where I wanted to keep the events that happened to her the same, but really change her motivation for doing things, because I thought that would be an interesting way to come at her story, particularly from a more modern and feminist perspective. So I used that. I used various other sources, such as the Dionysica, which was written by Nonnus, to get some details of Ariadne's later life and the relationship that she ends up having with Dionysus. And also kind of physical sources as well. So things like going to the British Museum and looking at artifacts from the Minoan age, sort of real objects that existed on Crete, even if they weren't actually connected to Knossos. So there is a necklace in the novel, at the very start of the novel, that I give to Ariadne. And that was a real necklace, a real pendant that was found on Crete. So it was the Malian pendant rather than being connected to the palace where Ariadne, the mythological figure of Ariadne, would have lived. But it gives you a real kind of sense of the textures and the materials and the kind of reality of this world. Because although I was telling a mythological story, I did want it to ring true as well and to feel like it was something that could have happened. So all of those kind of ideas, art, vase paintings, statues, are also, I think, really invaluable if you're writing a piece of classical mythology.
I think that's so interesting. I was struck by the way, so if we're going to talk about Ovid's Herodes and Phaedra's letter, she is posited as something almost entirely evil, whereas in your novel, she isn't at all. And without slagging off Ovid, because maybe that's not a very politic thing to do, his female characters are not the most multidimensional things in existence. She seems, whilst quite distressed, also just quite evil in a way, whereas your characters, I think you're very, very right to describe the ways in which you give them a greater sense of being real, which is really interesting.
Yeah, I think Ovid's interesting because he was giving voice to these female characters, which I think is quite exceptional in the time as well. But at the same time, his attitude towards women was definitely questionable. So yes, I think when you are taking these sources, I think you always do think about the context and who was writing them and whose voice is really behind it.
Yeah, and I think what you talked about having so many different sources and also not just textual sources is really interesting, because so many people, when you say the Greek myths or a Greek myth, think of them as having one author and one correct version, and that's why other ones are a retelling in square quote marks. But and then that makes a version which puts more emphasis on women or a feminist retelling new or in some way anachronistic to some people, but that isn't really the case, is it?
Well, yes, because yeah, completely agree. I mean, even when we talk about ancient Greece, we're not talking about the sort of physical area that we think of as Greece today. We talk it, you are kind of encompassing a much greater space and different regions and very, very disparate kind of regions as well. So all of these stories were being told simultaneously across the classical world. Across the ancient world, and then retold and retold and passed down through generations. And of course, they are always going to change depending on who's telling them and why. And I think Theseus is a great example of that, because he's an Athenian hero, because he is the founder, mythological founder of Athens. And so he's credited with almost inventing Athenian democracy kind of hundreds of years before it actually existed. So obviously some stories about Theseus are going to be really positive ones, but in other parts of the ancient world, they're not going to view him in such a in the same kind of light. So particularly in Crete, for example, where Theseus came and obviously waged war against them, it's going to be quite a different perspective that you have on that character. And that's the case for all the myths. I think there is absolutely no one definitive version. And they've belonged to all of us throughout history. And something that always frustrates me is how there's so many versions that we'll never even know. You know, so many ways that these stories will have been told that haven't been preserved and haven't been passed down to us. And who knows kind of what interesting slants there might have been on these female characters that are lost because they weren't deemed interesting enough or worthy enough by perhaps the people who were later on writing them down.
I think that's so interesting. Really, really interesting thing to think about. What I found really interesting in your novel is the way in which often when you think of characters in Greek myths, they're not properly human. A lot of them are half immortal or immortal. But even the mortal ones are so far away from our own lived experience now that they don't seem real at all. But in your book, you don't flinch from bodily weakness, something that feels it's so at odds with the gods and the mythical figures. We see both Phaedra and Ariadne are encumbered by children, suffer in childbirth. Were you conscious of that when you were writing it?
Yes, I think that's what's always drawn me to the myths, really. Well, certainly to rewriting them, is that desire to step into the world and really inhabit it. And really, you know, although these fantastical things are happening and there are gods and there are monsters, I really wanted it to feel real and I really wanted it to feel like something that could happen. So that was definitely a really conscious choice, because that's what I love about mythology, feeling like we can be part of the story.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And it's not just the female characters who you make so bodily real as well. The description of Daedalus and Icarus, you realize how that is also a bodily weakness, as well as a famous mythic story of how somebody flew too close to the sun. It was also the fault of the wax and then falling into the sea.
Yeah, I loved including that scene because I think it's so well known. It's almost stopped being a story, and it's more of a metaphor for us now. And so to actually go back and look at it through a different pair of eyes, so it's Phaedra who sees it happening from the ground, and make it feel as though it was something that she was truly witnessing. I just really enjoyed it. I think as somebody who loves mythology, reading it or writing it's so satisfying to get to these little moments, almost like Easter eggs that people will know about and people will have will be familiar with, but to hopefully just put a little twist on it and make it seem different.
And it opens it up to readers who probably, whilst they may know the metaphor, might not know the story as well, which is really, really fabulous. So I don't want to spoil the plot of the book too much, because whilst the myth has been around for a while, some people might not have read the novel, but your story puts a lot of emphasis on the importance of sibling bonds. So both the sisterly relationship between Ariadne and Phaedra, and another sibling relationship, which is Ariadne and the Minotaur or Asterion. So these bonds in one form transgress the man-beast divide, much like the Minotaur does himself. So were you aware of the importance of these bonds and these relationships when you were writing?
Yeah, so for Ariadne and Phaedra, absolutely, because they're both famous mythological women, and I had never come across a story that put them in the same place at the same time. Their stories had always been told separately and always told in relation to the men that they become involved with. So Ariadne's story is always told as part of Theseus's legend, and Phaedra's story, and you know, I mentioned the Euripides play, it's called Hippolytus. It's Hippolytus, the male character, who is the focus, even though Phaedra drives the action and is, you know, responsible for everything that happens, or, well, Phaedra slash Aphrodite, because the agency of the gods is hugely important as well. So although they sort of make these references, so in the play, Phaedra will reference the fact that she has this sister, and she references the fact that her mother was gave birth to the Minotaur and so on, we never see them as a family unit, never actually see them together. And that was something that I absolutely wanted to do. Chronology and ages is always very vague, obviously, in mythology. So I was able to decide on what the age difference might be and put them together, which I really enjoyed doing. Because it was so important to me to see Ariadne, like I said, not just through the perspective of this legend of Theseus, but to see her as a fully rounded human being. So she has a relationship with her mother, with her sister, and of course with this monstrous baby that's born into the family that has such a profound and devastating effect on them all. And for Asterion, the Minotaur himself, it was the duality of that name, the fact that his mother gave him a different name, that he wasn't the Minotaur, which obviously comes from Minos, who has no role to play in the creation of the monster. Minos isn't its father. The father is this sacred bull. But Minos exploits the monster that's born when he realizes how it can be useful to him. But Pasiphae, the Minotaur's mother, gives her child a name, and that name has the meaning to do with stars. And I thought that's really something quite beautiful and very different to what he was. And that suggested to me that there was a more tender relationship, or there could have been a more tender relationship. And if that was the case for Pasiphae, the mother, then also Ariadne is sometimes depicted as having this more affectionate relationship with the Minotaur as well. And that was something I definitely wanted to include, because I think what we see in Ariadne's story is that she's so much an idealist. You know, the fact that when Theseus arrives on Crete, she believes everything he tells her, and she agrees to take this huge risk in helping Theseus because she thinks that he is this hero who's come along and is going to do the right thing and is going to make things better. And I thought that was really part of her personality. And so she would be the same about the Minotaur, in my opinion as well. She wouldn't just look at it and think, this is a monster. She would look at it and think, this is my brother, my half brother, and he's part human. And what if we could nurture his humanity? Is there potential to be something else? Because the Minotaur is as much a victim, really, as anyone else. He's this punishment sent by the god Poseidon to the family. But it's not his fault that he is what he is. That's just his nature.
I think that's really, really brilliant. And are there any other versions of the myth in which there is a slightly more sympathetic relationship or not?
Yes. So Ariadne is quite often shown as in stories as having being the one person who can sort of communicate with the Minotaur, that she can kind of enter the labyrinth sometimes. I didn't include that idea in mind because I really did make him more of a monster by that stage. But yeah, there's definitely versions where she can go in and she can kind of soothe the monster, and she is, she's sometimes called Mistress of the Labyrinth. So she has this kind of greater role to play in the whole story. And there is a short story called The House of Asterion. And the name of the author has completely slipped my mind, and I don't know why that is. But that's a much more, that's from Asterion's perspective, that's from the Minotaur's perspective, and that is a much more kind of thoughtful and pathetic portrayal of him.
You talked there about how he's named for the stars, and constellations and stars are quite important in Greek myths and in your novel in particular. There's a brilliant moment where Dionysus removes Ariadne's coronet and throws it into the sky and it becomes a constellation. Do you want to speak a bit about the importance of stars and constellations in Greek myths and your novel in particular?
Yes, so it became this recurring theme in the novel because there are so many stories in Greek mythology where people are turned into stars, and I found that a really beautiful concept, but also quite terrifying. So there is the moment where Dionysus throws Ariadne's crown into the sky, and that's a real constellation. So the Corona Borealis, I'm not very good at pronunciations. So that is like a crown-shaped constellation in the sky. So that had a huge sort of significance, and I thought that was so poetic and such a wonderful moment to include. But then there were all these other stories as I was researching where these mortals are transformed into stars. And so there is I mention a few of them. So there's Orion, who was this kind of giant who had this involvement with Artemis, who is killed because he basically challenges Artemis's authority, her supremacy as a hunter. And after he's died, after he's killed, he's put into the sky as a constellation. And there is Callisto, who is raped by Zeus, and she and her son are both transformed into stars. And there's a few stories in that vein where these mortals meet a horrible end thanks to the gods and end up being constellations. And like I said, there's something really beautiful about it, but there's something so monstrous as well, in the idea that they are so become so remote and so distant, and they're just, you know, alone in the darkness. And that really symbolized something about these kinds of stories in Greek mythology to me, that there is like a, you know, something so poetic and mesmerizing about them, but there's this real brutality and this real terror at the heart of it as well. And those are two things that I really wanted to be part of my novel.
Yeah, I think you're right, because when I read it, I thought the moment where he throws the crown up into the sky is so beautiful, but there's something incredibly terrifying about, yeah, it's one of the less terrifying transformations that the gods wreak on the mortals in one way, but it's also just completely awful as well. Yeah. So in the Ariadne myth, weaving is very important, from the thread that allows Theseus to defeat the Minotaur to the tapestries that Phaedra orders to be woven in Athens. And also in some versions of the myth, Ariadne hangs herself after being abandoned by Theseus, but in your novel, Phaedra does. So some scholars think that Ariadne is a weaving goddess like Arachne. What do you think of this theory?
Well, weaving is always so important in Greek mythology. And I think because it's one of the skills. I mean, I think in the ancient world, really, it wasn't just women, but certainly all women would weave and would have to weave. And it was such a huge and crucial part of society. And it was also a way that stories are passed on. And so I've got a copy of Greek Myths by Charlotte Higgins, which came out a month or so ago, where she really uses that as a central motif. She has these female characters from mythology who weave all of these stories. And I really love how she does that and how she sums up this idea that creating, weaving the cloth that they did just goes hand in hand with telling the stories, and it's such an important way that stories were passed down. So it's always going to be a part of a mythological retelling, because it was something that all women would do and would have to do all the time. And I suppose it's a female skill, it's very linked to storytelling, and I liked the idea that it would be something where if women were doing it together, they would talk to each other as well, and that it would perhaps be a kind of freedom of communication for women. So so it definitely had to be part of the novel.
Yeah, and Charlotte Higgins is on next week's podcast, which is really fabulous. A double Greek mythology one. But I think it's so interesting, the way that it connects it all, and it's a sense of, so when Phaedra's ordering the tapestries to be woven, she's also weaving stories into them. So both storytelling on different levels, which is really, really interesting.
And I think Charlotte Higgins will articulate that so much better than I did when you speak to her next week.
So as we said earlier, often I think with myths we don't say take the sadness and tragedy quite as seriously as we might do if it was a modern story. And it's almost too well known to feel real, if that makes sense. But this isn't true in yours. At the end of the book, Dionysus ends up killing a whole town's young, and it's a moment which is wrought with true tragedy in your novel. How do you think you managed to achieve this?
Yes, that's absolutely true. That I think it's one of the functions that mythology really has. One of the reasons that we do keep passing these stories down is that it does give us that remove from these, a kind of a safe way to explore these really extreme emotions. And something that comes up over and over again in mythology is the loss of young children. And clearly, it was such a common thing to happen. Infant mortality was so much higher. And I think it's often spoken of because it was such a common thing to happen. It's often kind of brushed over as almost kind of not being the tragedy that it would be. But I think as somebody who, you know, I have two children, there's no way that I can imagine that anybody would give birth and just be and not feel the absolute devastation if they lost their child. You know, just because it's something that happens so frequently and happens so commonly, it would have been a devastating tragedy every time. And that's part of my second novel, Electra, as well, where Clytemnestra is absolutely driven to driven to commit very extreme actions, perhaps because of the loss of a child. And when Dionysus does that, and I think is that in the Bacchae that we see him do that, or we see him do these really terrible things in mythology and Greek drama and in the stories. And that particular story has never not struck me as horrifying. And I do think there is this kind of this way that we talk about these things in mythology as just being a story. But I'm never really like that about stories. I always feel like I'm inhabiting a story. And it always has an effect on me, I think. So these terrible dramatic things, I can't really view them through that lens of detachment. It becomes a really emotional thing for me. And definitely in writing this novel, like I said, I did want to make it feel real, and I did want to think about what it would be like to actually be there when that happened. And there's no way to just brush past it and just think this is kind of the petulant tantrum of a god displaying his power. But instead, this is a really brutal, terrible massacre. And I think people forgive Dionysus an awful lot of cruel behaviour because he's such a seductive god and because he's associated with wine and parties and having a good time. I think people tend to, or can sometimes perhaps like romanticise him a little bit more. And I really wanted to show both sides of his character and the real savagery at the heart of all the immortals.
Yeah, I think that's such an important thing to do. You mentioned your next book, Electra, which comes out in April. It'd be really interesting to talk about that. So it's about Electra from the Oresteia, from the Aeschylus play?
Yes, so it is, I based it on the Oresteia, which is a trilogy by Aeschylus, as you said, which follows the story of, in my novel, three women whose lives are shattered by their involvement with Agamemnon. So there's his wife, Clytemnestra, who I've mentioned. He betrays her very brutally, very cruelly, in a very kind of Dionysian way, except human and and very cold. And there is Cassandra, sorry, I just just lost my train of thought a little bit there. There's Cassandra, who is the Trojan priestess, and Agamemnon lays siege to her city for 10 years with his army of 1,000 ships that he's brought to reclaim Helen, his brother's wife, who's been abducted or run away with Paris, whichever version you take for that. And then there's Electra, Agamemnon's daughter, who has been growing up in the absence of her father, nurturing this very dangerous, deluded obsession about the nature of the kind of man that her father is, something that she is utterly, utterly blind to. And it's the way that these women's lives intersect and come into conflict with one another that I was really interested in retelling.
That's so brilliant. Yeah, and obviously Iphigenia as well is a woman whose life is cut very, very short by her father as
Yes,
well.
definitely. So the three women I mentioned are all narrators of the novel, but yes, Iphigenia obviously has a really crucial role to play. And it's just the same thing that I was talking about. I think that Clytemnestra's behaviour, I think the way that she's been characterised so often is as this kind of villainous, disloyal woman who behaves irrationally. And actually, I think when you look at what happened to her, her behaviour stops seeming quite so irrational, stops seeming quite so extreme when you consider the extreme things that she has suffered herself. So it ends up being primarily about Electra, but her experiences are so informed by her mother and by Cassandra that they had to be a really crucial part of the novel as well.
That sounds so exciting. I can't wait to read it. Thank you so much for such a brilliant chat.
Oh, that's great. Well, thank you so much for having me.
That was Jennifer Saint talking about her book Ariadne, which is out now. Subscribe to the Critic Books podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.